warning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, May 22nd, 2019. We begin with the news section. Carolyn Sullivan doesn't have time to be petty. After beating cancer, the Raleigh mayoral candidate thinks she can bring together an increasingly polarized city. Carolyn Sullivan describes herself as the world's luckiest unlucky person. In 2016, Sullivan was a member of the Wake County Board of Commissioners. After Democrats swept the board in 2014, the GOP-led General Assembly had overhauled how commissioners were elected, creating gerrymandered single-member districts and two super-districts, one of which Sullivan ran for. But late in the election season, a court threw out the new districts and reinstated the old. Sullivan was essentially left without a race. A few months later, another blow came. The day after Donald Trump's election, Sullivan learned she had breast cancer. It was a long, hard-fought battle, and she still bears the scars, but she beat it. Now she's ready for another fight. In March, Sullivan, the executive director of the North Carolina Business Committee for Education, a nonprofit operating out of the governor's office, announced she was running for mayor of Raleigh. She presents herself as a unifying force in a city polarized by issues of growth and neighborhood protection, and argues that she can push the city council to get out of the weeds and see the bigger picture. The Indy spoke with Sullivan, one of four declared candidates for mayor. The others are former council member and Sullivan's friend, Marianne Baldwin, Raleigh Mayor Charles Francis, and former council candidate Zanine Bullock. They spoke earlier this month about why she believes she's the best person for the job. This interview has been edited and condensed. You can listen to the entire conversation, including more on Sullivan's background and what drew her into politics, on IndyCast, which you can find on iTunes or Stitcher or SoundCloud.com/IndyCast. The Indy asked, "You've been out of politics for years. Why get back in it now?" She answered, "Sometimes in life and in politics, it's all about timing. The timing of what's good for the city and also what's good for the candidate. Personally, I am at a new juncture in my life. I will be an empty nester. I've been focused on my kids for a while, and now I'm ready to focus more holistically on the community and the city. In the city, it's a time of change and growth, and the problems we're facing are complex and need a collaborative approach to solve, both in the short term and in the long term. And I've got a history and a track record of doing that. I professionally worked in the federal system, federal government, the state government, the county government, and I now work in a nonprofit where we have business leaders addressing educational issues. I've been on many boards that focus on everything from early intervention and mental health and child abuse to housing. So I think I am able to synthesize the systems, the nonprofits in this community, in a way that is helpful as we reach this point in the city." The Indy then asked, "We've heard that Mayor Nancy McFarland asked you to run. She's been frustrated in how things have been going on the council for a couple of months. Are there things that frustrate you about with the direction the city's headed in?" She answered, "Number one, especially in times of change and growth, you need to get out ahead with your vision. What's the shared vision of the community? And how do you bring people together to come up with the shared vision? Because then it's easier to move forward with policies if we all know what we're working toward. But also, I think some of what is going on at the federal level and the state level is starting to bleed down into local politics, which is really unfortunate and unnecessary. These are not partisan boards. I am an eternal optimist, and I believe people are good. And I think that if we can figure out where each other are coming from, we can come up with a solution. I heard what Nancy was talking about with a reset, and I think things have gotten kind of toxic, and I don't think they have to be. Danny then said, there seems to be this ideological divide between people who want to preserve what they believe makes Raleigh a great place and people who want to embrace the city's growth. Where do you see yourself? She answered, sometimes when there's a time of great change, you want to try to keep everything the same, and that's understandable. But the growth is going to happen, so we got to figure out as a community, how do we grow together forward and not leave people behind? And I think we need to have that conversation. A lot of these big complex issues, we've been focusing on one or two little strategies. And you've got to have a lot of strategies all fired at the same time. But you've got to do it under this umbrella of a shared vision and path forward. The NA next asked, one big proposal is John Cain's plan to build a 40-story tower which wouldn't border on any single-family neighborhoods. Is this how we need to build density downtown? She answered, I think it's a balance between neighbors that are there and where you're building the density, and you're building in places where there aren't that many neighbors. We've got to have more density, and we have to have more stock. That's part of the problem. There's a supply and demand portion of this discussion to where we're growing a lot, and there are not enough places for people to go. So density's where it makes sense. Next, Andy said, you've talked about providing opportunities and lifting up a diverse group of people. My question is, how are we able to combat gentrification in a way that also embraces the growth we're seeing? She answered, it's hard. And it's another issue that cities all over are facing. Where people want to live has changed, and the demographics of that city has also changed. Some of the people love it, and it's less folks with 2.5 children who are going to public schools and want to live in the suburbs. And a lot of times it's more older people who don't want houses or young people who don't want or can't afford houses. But a lot of people want to live close to downtown. There is a generation coming up changing their relationship with the automobile, which is something we need to look at when we're thinking about transit and roads in the future. But when it comes to the changing of the cities, you have to go back to the comprehensive plan. That is one of the pieces of this complex issue, and how can you try to protect what you have, you know, protect the stock that you have that's affordable before it gets sold to something not affordable. And also, how do you engage with the community on strategies through different funding sources to try and protect people who need to sell, but might not want to sell to a developer who might put up something that's substantially different than what is there now? There's also this piece of community. Is community the exact house where you live? Is community what things look like? Or is community who you are? And how do you build community in a different way? I am a firm believer that the path forward out of the issue Raleigh has, and let's face it, this is a fantastic place. Is that what we have? Got to figure out, how do we bring it together, and how do we do it as a community? We view each other not as neighbors and family, but as the other. And that's dangerous. And a lot of the reason why we can't view each other as the other is because we just don't have the opportunity to know each other. That's the kind of community that we're also talking about. Next, the Indy said, zoning questions are a part of the bigger vision question. The council seems to pay very close attention to a vocal minority, and council members are very hesitant to make anyone upset. Are you willing to make some of those hard choices? She answered, life is all about hard choices, but I think you need to bring everybody together. And I think when you have a real conversation, that's not coming from a place of animosity, but coming from a place of value that we can all go forward as a community together. The county's transit initiative didn't make everybody happy. Nobody walked out of the transit process getting everything they wanted, but everybody walked out of it feeling heard and understanding what these choices were. When all of this energy is about housing, which is fantastic, we need to harness that, get leaders from the county and the city and nonprofits and developers and funders and all of the banks, people who are all in the space that can work on this together, because it is not going to go away. Next, the Andy said, you served on Wake County Board of Commissioners from 2012 to 2016. What were your biggest achievements? She said, when I got elected, and this is the thing people need to understand, politicians will listen to you. A constituent I never met before gave me a call, and she was a nurse and getting a graduate degree, but he also had a child with some significant health challenges. She was in Apex, where it was one nurse for 2,850 students, which is appalling. The General Assembly has never supported nurses in Wake. So I worked with the county staff and one of my Republican colleagues to get it in the budget, the first substantial expansion in the human services that we have had post-recession, and then adding 10 nurses a year for 4 years. People in my kids' schools and the teachers still say that's the most impactful thing. The second thing, I think, is mental health. I was the point person on mental health in the county. It's a complex issue. We launched the Wake Network of Care. It's a one-stop shop for human services and support. And it's got a national mental health library and all of the crisis lines, and we funded a position to keep that up. I had another constituent who wanted to talk about the gender gap, which it turns out in Wake County is worse than the gender gap nationally. And when the constituent came to talk to me, I did some research and decided we needed to look into it. We had a task force where we had great leaders work together for 9 months on recommendations on how to address this gender gap. We decided to form a collective impact model called Wake Invests in Women, and I still serve on that advisory board. This is important, not just for the equality piece of it. It's important because we need everybody in this community to work to their greatest ability, because we need to grow a talent pipeline in the city. The Indy next said, so 2016 was a tough year for you. First, you were essentially prevented from running for re-election, and then the day after Trump was elected president, you got some pretty devastating news. She said, yes, I was diagnosed with breast cancer the day after the election. It's just the whole world falling apart for Carolyn that day. I'm pretty tough, so I've never, you know, I'm not wanting to feel sorry for myself, and I'm wanting just to think, what do we need to do? I just moved forward with the surgery and, you know, that kind of treatment we needed to do. Just the timing was really interesting and ironic. But I'm lucky. I'm a very lucky unlucky person. I had good insurance and great doctors, and we have good hospitals and lots of support and fantastic family and friends. Cancer's a journey. I think at the end of the day, if you're lucky enough to have all of these supports, it'll make you strong. Next, the Indy asked, how do you think cancer changed your approach to politics? She said, you have a different view of what's important, and time. I'm less likely to get upset about personal slights, and I'm less likely to want to spend my time being spiteful or vengeful or any of those things. I never really was much of that anyway. But I think life's a gift, and, you know, none of us have unlimited amounts of time. And if you view how lucky we are, and if you have the gift to be able to have time and the experience and the ability to try to make things better for people, you should. The Indy then said, so this lets you put aside the pettiness that comes with politics. She answered, I'm not going to fall into any sort of toxic trap. It's unnecessary and unhelpful. I'm trying to talk to everybody. I think one of the things that the mayor can do is to try to bring the council together, and that is to understand where everybody's coming from and what is important to their district and what their district needs. But also being able to take the long view of the city and how does that all fit together. The Indy next asked, and there are other people in this race who have had experience on the city council. What makes you the best person to lead the city in 2020? She answered, my skill set and how I approach government and challenge is the right fit for right now. I'm not running against anybody. I'm running for what I think I can do to help my community. I think it's great so many people are running, actually. But I think at this time, the city needs somebody who has experience and a track record of taking on complex problems and finding ways to address them holistically, systematically, and having people be a part of it. And Indy said, and that person's you? She said, that's what I think. Next, from the Soapboxer, welcome to Gilead. Obama's abortion ban isn't about abortion. It's about control. Last Tuesday, 24 scientifically illiterate white men in Alabama who believe they are on a mission from their invisible sky deity declared that a doctor who terminates the pregnancy of a 12-year-old rape victim, a routine, humane, and societally uncontroversial medical procedure everywhere else in the developed world, should spend more time in prison than the rapist who impregnates her. Last Wednesday, Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill into law proclaiming, it's a powerful testament to Alabamians' deeply held belief that every life is precious and that every life is a sacred gift from God. About that sacred gift, Alabama has the worst education system, the second highest infant mortality rate, the fifth highest child poverty rate in the country, with 1 in 4 kids living below the poverty line, most of them clustered in majority black counties. Half of the state's counties have no obstetrician. Nearly 90% of its rural hospitals are bleeding red ink. And, of course, the state has refused to expand Medicaid. Like a car that leaves the lot, that sacred gift becomes a lot less valuable the second it slips out of the birth canal. What Ivy meant to say is not that every life is sacred, but, to borrow from Monty Python, that every sperm is sacred. Actually, not even that, and not even that every fertilized egg is sacred, because Alabama's abortion ban doesn't apply to fertilized eggs stored in a lab. Only fertilized eggs inside women. Coincidentally, white women of means are more likely to use in vitro fertilization. Women of color account for about 2/3 of Alabama abortions. It's not even about abortion either. If Alabama really wanted to further reduce the number of abortions, the number of Alabama abortions fell 41% from 2005 to 2016, before an uptick in 2017, it could follow Colorado's lead and make widely available free and low-cost IUDs. After Colorado began doing that in 2009, its teen birth rate declined by 54% and its teen abortion rate dropped by 64% over the next 8 years. An ounce of prevention, after all, is worth a pound of cure. But again, preventing abortion is not what this law is all about. It's about control. What this law seeks to codify, and what Alabama lawmakers truly consider sacred, is the right of a small but politically powerful cohort of social conservatives to dictate traditional gender roles and enforce sexual mores according to their interpretation of fundamentalist dogma. Indeed, in neither Alabama nor anywhere else does such an aggressive attack on reproductive rights have majority support. Even Pat Robertson, yes, that Pat Robertson, thinks it's extreme. Alabama isn't alone, of course. Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio, and Missouri have all undertaken similar efforts with bills that ban abortion when a heartbeat can be detected, usually around 6 to 8 weeks of gestation, under the theory that having a heartbeat imbues a fetus with personhood. Never mind that it's not a heartbeat. At this stage of development, a fetus the size of a shrimp and lacking a central nervous system doesn't have a heart. What's being detected is a cardiac activity from tissue called a fetal pole. Then again, it's not like the anti-choice crew have ever been sticklers for science. Georgia's ban includes exemptions for victims of rape and incest. The laws in Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri, like Alabama, do not. By design, all of this is unconstitutional, or rather, explicitly designed to force the Supreme Court to reassess abortion's constitutionality. Almost a half century ago, Roe v. Wade legalized the right to abortion. 2 decades later, Casey v. Planned Parenthood affirmed that right. The Supreme Court has held that states cannot prevent women from attaining abortions before a fetus is viable, roughly through the second trimester. But with 2 new uber-conservative Supreme Court justices on the bench, appointed by a president of dubious legitimacy and confirmed by a Senate that represented a clear minority of the American population, anti-choice activists see opportunity. Though neither the science nor the legal arguments have changed since Casey, they believe Donald Trump's right-wing court majority will simply disregard precedent and throw Roe out the window, embracing the textbook definition of judicial activism conservatives claim to loathe. And you know what? They're probably right. Which makes you wonder, what's next? Gay marriage? Further erosions of civil rights? Authoritarian power grabs? For the right, desperate to impose its will as it slips into a demographic and cultural minority, if the courts are no longer willing to be democracy's backstop against extremism, then everything's on the table. The worst-case scenario we warned you about in 2016, it's here. The next news article, The Beautiful Business of Decomposition. As climate change looms, composting is becoming more popular, but the industry is surprisingly precarious. 30 years ago, this 30-acre patch of dirt in southwestern Chatham County was a dairy farm. Today, full of big machines busily moving piles around, it's growing something else. When a kid tosses out her French fries at a Chapel Hill school, when a Durham Co-op customer doesn't finish his chickpeas, or when a Raleigh Compost Now subscriber puts a bucket of scraps out to be whisked away, this is where it all ends up. Brooks Contractor, one of the Triangle's only large-scale composting facilities. Brooks has been engaged in composting since the early 1990s, but the company has faced hard times. These days, though, it's on the upswing thanks to Compost Now, a small but fast-growing company that somehow managed to make composting sexy. Together, Brooks and Compost Now have created their own small ecosystem, symbiotically harvesting most of the residential and consumer-driven compost in the Triangle and reaping profits in the process. But as composting goes mainstream and cities like Durham consider progressive new policies, that tenuous balance could shift. The change would likely be a win for the region's residents, but it could significantly alter the landscape for the current big players. First, though, a tutorial. Composting, of course, is the act of letting organic matter decay naturally, something gardeners and eco-minded folks have been doing for decades. But with climate change an ever-looming threat, the practice has gotten more notice, and for good reason. Composting aficionados talk about how composting closes the loop on the farm-to-table philosophy. It returns organic matter to its origins so that it can once again be productive. In contrast, Food and paper products that go to a landfill take up critical space, produce methane, a greenhouse gas, and can never be used again. In the United States, food scraps make up roughly 22% of waste, the largest single component. A 2016 Durham waste study found that about 30% of the city's trash is compostable. So, if we want to cut down on the amount of trash going to the landfill, the best place to start is with food. There are other benefits to composting, too. It captures carbon, reducing the amount in the air. It also adds fertilizer and beneficial microbes to soil, cutting down on the need for pesticides and artificial fertilizers. Most North Carolina soils have less than 1% organic matter. When you add compost, you're jump-starting all that activity, says Frank Franciosi, the Raleigh-based director of the U.S. Composting Council. There are all these positive ecosystem services that you get by producing and using compost. Those advantages are well known now, though they weren't when Dean Brooks was seeking an alternative to dairy farming in 1989. But he saw an opportunity in the state's new Solid Waste Management Act, which banned some organic waste from landfill, and he began collecting debris from chicken hatcheries. It was a start, but his facility didn't really begin flourishing for a decade, not until Orange County sought his help boosting its composting program. We engaged with Brooks and set up a contract whereby Orange County paid Brooks to pick up food waste from larger-scale commercial generators, recalls Blair Pollock, a solid waste planner with the county. That launched Brooks' foray into composting food scraps on a larger scale, something novel at the time. I think we were the first company on the East Coast to collect organic waste the way we do and compost it, says Amy Brooks Fulford, Brooks' food waste collection manager and partial owner of the family business. She is Dean's daughter and grew up at the facility. Orange County wound up launching what's been the Triangle's most forward-thinking composting program. For a while, the county paid Brooks to collect food waste from big generators like UNC, both the university and the hospital, as well as Whole Foods, Weaver Street Market, and the Chapel Hill Restaurant Group's eateries. Eventually, it sent most of them off to negotiate their own contracts with Brooks, though the county's program still covers about 40 local restaurants and institutions. At every elementary and middle school in the Chapel Hill Carborough City school system, kids segregate their food waste and Brooks picks it up for composting, for which the company is paid about $40,000 a year. Because the system's trash pickup costs are reduced, that program is cost neutral. In 5 years, the school system has diverted 1.3 million pounds of food waste from the landfill. Meanwhile, other institutions got on the bandwagon. Duke University has been collecting and sending its compost to Brooks for years, as has the EPA office in the Research Triangle Park. For Brooks, this has all been good news. The compost biz is surprisingly precarious. The material might be waste, but transporting it costs money, and the machinery needed to pick up, turn, screen, and deliver it comes with a high price tag. A single piece of equipment can cost $500,000. Today, though, the company, which is deeply invested in advancing sustainable practices in the region, processes about 65,000 tons annually, assisting with transport and providing a destination facilities. There, over the course of 6 months to a year, organic waste slowly turns into rich black dirt. The finished compost has found its way to the landscape yards of new developments all over the Triangle, as well as farms and university campuses, including Duke Gardens. Composting isn't yet at a point where it makes good economic sense, though. In Orange County, the institutions that donate food scraps to Brooks benefit from lower trash pickup costs. But the entire operation is subsidized by the county, which pays Brooks up to $180,000 a year. For businesses that have their own contracts with Brooks, the costs can vary. Smaller businesses, if they really sharpen their pencil, can get close to making diversion of food waste pay for itself, says Pollack. Close yet, but not all the way there. At this point, it's still cheaper to simply throw food scraps away, which means that for many companies, composting is a mission-driven decision. But that dynamic changed somewhat when CompostNow entered the market. Started in 1911 by Matt Rosater of Raleigh, the compost collection company has seen exponential growth, quickly gobbling up competitors, filthy rich compost, and food forward. The business now also operates in Asheville, Charleston, and Atlanta, but about half of its 5,000 members are in the Triangle. With its ease of use, reasonable prices, and good timing, CompostNow has managed to make rotting vegetation cool, and it's achieved something else that diehard environmentalists have been waiting for. They planted that seed of, this isn't waste, it's a valuable resource that's not being used properly, says Franciosi of the U.S. Composting Council. In essence, CompostNow has served as an ambassador for the practice. The message has certainly got through to Lakeisha Chickister, a Durham resident and enthusiastic CompostNow customer. She says she's no tree hugger. A co-worker turned her on to the benefits of composting. After that conversation, every time I scraped something into the trash, I thought about it. What am I doing? Why am I taking something that could be used and putting it in the trash? She's Chickister. Like two-thirds of the company's clients, she doesn't ask for the finished compost, which is free to customers. It simply feels like the right thing to do. This sentiment is becoming increasingly common. Office-based composting, for example, has been taking off, unlike anything we've seen before, says Kat Negro, the head of marketing and engagement for CompostNow. We see this demand from employees to work in a sustainable, environmentally focused office. Employers are thinking it helps attract talent. CompostNow also services Wake County's compost collection sites and hundreds of smaller institutional clients all over the region. But that expansion is possible only through its collaboration with Brooks Contractor. CompostNow specializes in collecting, sorting through, and cleaning out compost bins, something Brooks doesn't really have time for. Meanwhile, Brooks provides the acreage, machinery, the know-how to create the final product. Together, they found a mutually beneficial balance. This being a relatively nascent industry, however, that balance could shift. And it might. Durham has big plans that could make it a leader in composting across the state and perhaps even the nation. But that could affect CompostNow's business model. At the moment, Durham contracts with the company Atlas Organics to compost its yard waste at a facility on East Bull Club Boulevard. But the city owns 5 acres of compost sheds that are permitted to receive the compost food scraps as well as biosolids. The latter is treated sewage sludge, a.k.a. human feces. Its use on food crops is mildly controversial, but the substance is heavily regulated and tested by the EPA to ensure its safety. Like animal manure, it increases soil fertility. What all of that means is that Durham could be doing far more composting than it currently is, and it's fixing to change that. Once this exceptionally wet spring dries out, Atlas will experiment with composting a combination of yard waste and biosolids. Meanwhile, the city government will research and pilot a program to collect household food scraps. The city is really interested in making this happen, says Muriel Williman, Durham's senior assistant solid waste manager. She was hired 5 months ago to help guide this initiative. How exactly it'll all work is unclear, but some big brains are on it. Durham's innovation team, which is funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies, together with Duke Center for Advanced Hindsight, have taken on the project and are currently examining best practices around the country and the barriers that Durham faces. In 6 to 12 months, they'll pilot a curbside collection program with about 200 households that are already signed up for yard waste collection, and then just see how it goes. Durham will also establish drop-off sites for food waste. If municipal curbside compost collection succeeds, though, it would be first in the state and make Durham one of the only of a few municipalities in the country to compost all three types of organic waste that a city produces: yard waste, biosolids, and food waste. The ramifications are huge, not to mention the carbon reduction, says William. Talk about resilient cities. We could do it all of it for ourselves. But if Durham established residential curbside food waste pickup and did its own composting, the big loser would be Compost Now, which has hundreds of subscribers in the city. Brooks, with his wider customer base, would be less affected, although that might change too, if Durham's initiative goes well and other municipalities start their own composting programs. Already, Carborough officials are mulling launching their own curbside food scrap pickup effort. Compost Now said it's not concerned, and who knows? Durham might decide to hire Compost Now to do the curbside pickup. After all, that's what the company does. No matter what, no one's going to suffer too badly. As everyone in the industry agrees, there's more than enough organic waste to go around. The next article from Indy Food: Boylan Bridge has fallen down. Boylan Bridge Brew Pub, which had killer views of downtown Raleigh but struggled to draw a crowd, closed Sunday. Its new owners have big plans and a new name for the space. It's a beautiful, balmy late spring evening just before sunset. A warm, gentle breeze drifts through a wood-covered patio bar nestled atop one of the highest vantage points in the city. Sweeping views of a burgeoning skyline adore the horizon. A cold beer in hand, you pause to take it all in. Or maybe pose for pictures with your companion against the metropolitan backdrop. The setting is perfect, and yet something is amiss. Where is everybody? Chris Borenson and Sarah Abernathy had the same question the first time they passed by the Boylan Bridge Brew Pub. Established by architect Andrew Leger in 2006, a year after Pop the Cap and the vanguard of Raleigh craft beer scene, the brew pub's patio has been known for having the best view of downtown Raleigh, despite being, or maybe because it was, so often empty. It was a perfect 65-degree evening in December of 2017, and the San Diego transplants came upon the bar and wondered if it was open. It was, but no one was inside. We ask ourselves, imagine what we could do with this place, said Abernathy. The newlyweds hadn't considered opening a brewery when they moved to Raleigh, Abernathy's hometown. That was in May of 2017. But with Boylan, the opportunity presented itself. Family friends introduced the couple to Leger, who initiated a conversation about a partnership, which evolved into a plan to transfer the bar's ownership altogether. Leger was ready to retire. Running the bar, he told Morrison, has been very hard. By September of 2018, the couple had acquired the brew pub. They immediately began devising a new concept, including a new name. On Sunday, Boylan Bridge officially ended its run, and its place opening June 5th, Wee Hill Kitchen and Brewing. This name is connected to their vision for a space as an inclusive neighborhood bar. The reason why this view is the most unbelievable view is because this building is built over a wee. It's where trains change direction, Abernathy explains. But the wee is not only symbolic for a change in direction, it's also a hub where we meet and part ways, a stopover that takes us from place to another. The first order of business was to improve the beers on tap. That began several months ago. They hired Bride Wynn, formerly of Big Boss and Pennsylvania's Victory, who switched to local malts and developed six new nano-batch beers, one of which, a delightful sour, was a refreshingly tart complement to a recent hot day on the patio. They hope to offer up to 16 small-batch beers on-site and eventually sell bottles elsewhere. The same creative flair will go into Wee Hill's boutique wine offerings, which will include several on tap that will rotate through the seasons. Max Trujillo, who was hired as a consultant, is developing pre-made batch cocktails, old fashions, margaritas, that will be served as a short and paired with a beer. "We're a brewery first," Trujillo says. "The beer is preliminary, then it's culinary, then cocktail, but it all pushes back to the brewery." Which is exactly where the concept behind Wee Hill's chef-driven bar food comes in. Bobby McFarland, Royale, Café La Carne, has developed a menu more appealing to herbivores than the heavy classic pub fare of Leaguer's Reign. From a chicken salte bianco, an Italian-style chicken breast served over cheesy purple grits, to Fox Farm and forage mushrooms drizzled with garlic and honey, to beer-forward Pilsner's mussels with chorizo, to Durham snap peas with tahini yogurt topped with hazelnuts and fresh mint, inclusive decadence is a common theme. The new menu will also include a pub's cheese upgrade and a super sexy burger, a short rib, a sirloin blend from First Hand Foods topped with fries and pickled okra. Wee Hill, with initially open for dinner, eventually expanding to lunch and dinner 6 days a week, and serving food until 11, and then possibly later. Now, from the indie food section, Tempura Temptation. Mike Lee's ode to Japanese deep frying pursues perfection and comes pretty close. Halfway through dinner at Tempura, a piece of pure magic appeared on my enamel tray. A stout half moon of eggplant encased in an ethereal cloud of translucent batter. I cradled it between my chopsticks and took a bite. The crisp shell crackled gently, the interior molten like a campfire marshmallow. In its yielding cloudy of earthy sweetness was the essence of eggplant, brought to its apogee by absolute care and precision. In a meal that was essentially a procession of impeccable marvels, it stood out as the apotheosis. The best Japanese food is born out of a monistic dedication to technique. Many of the culture's most beloved gastronomic exports, sushi, kashiki, ramen, lie at the fulcrum of cooking and craft, and to prepare them at the highest level requires rigorous practice. This acute attention to detail and the idea that it provides elite-level dining experiences has made Japanese cuisine immensely popular in the United States. This has naturally brought a wave of establishments that have, at best, a shallow understanding of the devotion required to get things just right. Tempura could easily have ridden the currents of fashion to a position of comfortable mediocrity. Instead, it pursues perfection, and often comes astoundingly close to achieving it. Tempura is about the batter, a delicate Christmas surrounding one or two bite-sized morsels with little or no adornment. The batter must be mixed to order and kept icy cold lest it become stodgy and doughy. The oil must be immaculate, the temperature monitored assiduously. It's tricky, even for deep-fry experts. Originally a technique for making a meal of green beans less depressing, tempura was brought to Japan in the 16th century by the Portuguese. It quickly blossomed into an ongoing game of, can we fry this? And eventually achieved ubiquity. While it's now found everywhere, from humble bento lunches to noodle soups, tempura is best experienced by tempura ya, temples of batter and oil, where the meal is an omakase procession of expertly fried bits of seafood, vegetable, and other delicacies. M. tapura is a classic tapuraya, one of only a handful in the United States. If it seems strange that such a place has landed in Durham, well, it is. Chef Michelle Lead envisioned M. tapura as a someday restaurant, a down-the-line addition to his mini empire founded on the excellent M. Sushi. But Lee moved the idea to the front burner when presented with the opportunity to take over the old scratch baking spot on Orange Street. Cozy and intimate, with a roomy kitchen and the footprint of a dining counter, the space was perfect for tempura ya. Dinner service at M. tapura is available in a 3 multi-course set, each launched with a few palate-preparing bites before moving on to the main event. We started with a salad of local greens and shaved cauliflower dressed in a ginger vinaigrette that I happily associate with the salad served at a strip mall Japanese steakhouse and antecedents to yelling, chopping, and shrimp flipping. Although a bit more elegant and certainly more subtle, it serves the same purpose here, a cleansing bite of green as a prelude to spectacle. Next came a crudo of bluefin tuna. Yes, bluefin is delicious, but here it's an unnecessary indulgence, especially when plopped half-heartedly in a pool of ponzu and roe and slivers of radish that end up looking like scattered handful of fancy-looking stuff that slides off into a pile at the very idea of being picked up and eaten. Perhaps it's an afterthought because the evening's main event soon obliterates any lingering doubts caused by familiar-tasting salads and raw fish false starts. Each dinner is presented with a tray upon which rests the DIY accoutrements of proper tempura eating. The essence of tempura is how the natural flavors of simple ingredients are highlighted and enhanced by the delicate batter and precision cooking, so each fryer-bound item is essentially unseasoned. Flavoring is finished bite-in as up to the diner, to whom the server helpfully provides a tiny bowl of salt and a sliver of lemon, ensconced in a ship-faced metal squeezer. A subtle dipping sauce of dashi, mirin, and soy gets a dollop of shaved daikon and nestles alongside a small bowl of pickles in candy, vibrant shades. The scene set, the tempura begins to arrive. It's appropriate that the procession begins with shrimp, the tempura-treated sea creature with which American diners have the most familiarity. This shrimp bears zero remembrance, however, to whatever late 90s fusion holdover P.F. Chang somehow forgot to sakoar from its menu. The batter is in a class by itself, impossibly crisp and dainty, not so much dissolving on the tongue as evaporating. The shelled shrimp tail is wonderfully meaty and sweet, but the whole soft-shell version is a lesson in spiny deliciousness, little shrimp heads exploding with juicy brine. Vegetables follow, shiitake mushroom chewy and savory, asparagus flamboyantly in season, tender and lemonly sweet, a chunk of lotus root that flirts with undercooking, but thanks to impeccable frying, emerges apple crunchy and satisfying. The eggplant. I believe I mentioned the eggplant. There are a few missteps. The okra, raw-tasting, slides clumsily out of its battered shell and casually to the vicissitudes of fryer time. The salmon is visually enticing, but weirdly disappointing, unctuous, and overly rich. One of the only dishes that felt like less than the sum of its parts. Another caveat, the dining room's overworked ventilation system practically guarantees that you will leave infused with ambient fryer aroma, which may or may not be a problem depending on how often you want to revisit your meal over the next few hours. It's a neat trick to experiment with seasoning along the way. Some dishes take well to a dunk in the ambrosial sauce. Others need a sprinkling of salt and a squirt of lemon. Others require no help at all, like the Miro sea bass, dense and hardy, but flaky and yielding within its shell of batter. It's essentially the world's greatest fish finger. Most of these dishes, in fact, conjure a childlike sense of fried food satiety, only streamlined and sophisticated. The scallop tastes like a fairy tale version of something you might get on a boardwalk, dumped with fries in a paper basket. The sweet potato, the only thing on the menu to be partially cooked before frying, would be a perfect accompaniment to a hunk of BBQ. The limited drink list at first seems like a final quibble, but the selections end up pairing perfectly with the meal. Both a squeaky clean Sankera and an ice-cold Asahi are charming accomplices, but only server effortless recommended an excellent sake, which stole the show with its dry finish and round texture. In the case of a restaurant like M. Tempura, any drink list, appetizer, or ambiance is going to end up ancillary to what is primarily a long-form technical masterpiece, the aim of which is to deliver simple and perfectly executed comfort food. By the time the final set pieces arrived, a bowl of toothsome soba noodles followed by a few bites of ginger ice cream, I had stopped being impressed and remained merely delighted. Now, from the indie music section, Feed the Meter. Jan Westerlund, a man alone in the wild regions of rhythm. Man Alone, Jan Westerlund's new album as Quertico, opens with a flurry of rhythm. The title track starts with a stuttering set of chords outlining a lopsided beat that seems to toggle between groups of three in two different tempos. The synth tone is warm, with a slightly percussive click. A higher synth tone comes in, bell-like, on a different subversion. A lower kick drum, like pulse, hits on yet another. Just when you can almost start to intuit the beat, a dramatic swoosh ushers in an explosion of drum pattern, and that's just the first 30 seconds. For the rest of the song, Westerlund juggles these competing patterns with ease in a way that seems unstable yet totally in time, even as he occasionally slips into something like a pop or jazz groove. As a drummer, Westerlund is unsurprisingly intrigued by the possibilities of rhythm. What sets him apart from many drummers, though, is his eagerness to explore more unusual patterns, beats in groups of five or seven, or patterns that occasionally stray from the even pulse that defines so much rock and pop. Over coffee on a sunny Thursday morning, it quickly becomes clear how thoroughly he has absorbed these odd meter grooves. He often breaks into scatting to demonstrate the kind of patterns that he is thinking about. Ba-ba-bat, 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 ba-ba-bat. Westerlund has been a triangle mainstay for nearly a decade, playing in groups such as Bowerbirds, Mipso, Phil Cook, and Canine Heart Sounds, Lost in the Trees, and numerous others. As enjoyable as these bands have been for him, he said, I just finally realized that I needed to make something on my own to feel satisfied musically in all corners. I hit a point where I wasn't feeling that this or that song was fitting this group or that group. And if they were, they were changing too much, and I wasn't as excited about them. Westerlund plays practically everything on Man Alone's 9-instrument tracks, which allowed him to take his music wherever he wanted without compromise. Consequently, questions of solitude are central to his conception of the band, which is named after Quetico Provincial Park in Ontario, a place he closely associates with being alone. Westerlund's training in rhythm started early. Growing up in Wisconsin, he was a jazz-obsessed kid diving into John Coltrane and Miles Davis. He joined the first band in sixth grade. We covered everything from Run-DMC to the Mortal Kombat theme song to anything we wanted, recalls. His older brother, Joe Westerlund, also was a big influence. We shared a bedroom for a long time, and we would play me records and records and records. The record stack included Albert Eiler and Ornette Coleman. Then Westerlund moved to Duluth to attend the University of Minnesota, where he majored in jazz and spent his days honing his drum chops, learning to play piano, and making his first forays into composition. And those complex rhythms kept appearing. I would play along to Brad Meledaw records and just hash out a 7/4 groove for 3 hours every night. Or he would challenge himself to keep a pattern of triplets grouped in five and see how long I could go until my brain melted. He was listening to Tiki Obmar, a short-lived Minneapolis group that played Aphex Twin-style beats in the context of a live trio, and jazz players like The Bad Plus, Chris Speed, and Tim Byrne. In 2009, he followed his brother Joe and friends Brad and Phil Cook, the trio that composed Megaphone, to the Triangle, where he quickly found a sympathetic musical scene. In 2012, Westerlund played on the last Bowerbirds album, The Clearing, and he credits Phil Moore and Milk Paulson with pushing him in new directions. Phil can write some of the best oddly phrased songs, he said, playing with them. I started to go down that path a little bit. Let's drop a beat, let's add a beat to the end of that phrase to add a little tension. Through all this, Westerlund started writing the compositions that would become Man Alone. While dog-sitting for Phil Cook one Christmas shortly after moving to Raleigh, Westerlund was playing Cook's piano when something clicked. Little ideas for songs started pouring out. Some of them found their way into the various bands, but mostly he just kept to himself, slowly refining them over the years. When he joined the indie-based group Mipso, he decided it was time to forge a sound that satisfied all of his musical inclinations. He bought recording equipment and synthesizers and then got to work. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.